This is a CBC podcast.
Support for delivery of this podcast comes from the Buick Enclave, the finest luxury crossover ever. Visit buick.gm.ca to see that where there's passion, there's beauty.
Hello, I'm Michael Enright, and this is the Rewind Podcast. This week on the podcast, another gem from the CBC Radio Archives, first heard on Rewind, the radio program. I hope you enjoy it.
Hello, I'm Judy Madryn, sitting in for Michael Enright. This is Rewind. Today on the show, an hour of David Suzuki. For more than three decades, he has been Canada's environmental conscience. He started his career experimenting with fruit flies and became fascinated with genetics. In the early 70s, he started appearing as a guest on several television programs because he wanted to share with a wider audience his love for and concern about science. In 1975, he was the founding host of the CBC radio program Quirks and Quarks. His aim had always been to make science relevant, interesting, and full of wonder. Our first piece on today's show gives a bit of insight about Suzuki's background and inspiration. It first aired in 1975 on the program Concern. The interviewer is Warren Davis.
Let's talk about David Suzuki, the man, rather than David Suzuki, the scientist. And yet, I guess you can't separate the two. When in your life did you decide to become a scientist?
That happened, actually, in my fourth year in college. I went through school in Canada to grade 13 in London, actually. And then I was fortunate enough to get a scholarship to go to a very good private school in the United States. And I was a pre-medical student and was planning on coming back to Western in medical school. So I honored in biology. And in my third year, I had to take a course in genetics. I had no idea what genetics was. It was a required course. That was all I knew. I walked into this thing, and within a week, it was the first time in all my academic experience that I could not wait to get back to the next lecture. This man was an incredible teacher.
Who?
His name is Dr. William Hexter. He was my professor in genetics. And every lecture, he opened my eyes to something that I never realized was so beautiful and was there and subject to attack and analysis. And so it was a very exciting experience for me. Well, the next year I asked him if I could work on a research problem with him. And I went into his lab and became so excited by that experience that I said, forget medical school, I want to go on. Mind you, I never thought I would ever be a great scientist. I knew I wanted to teach, and I knew I could teach fairly well. And so my aim was ultimately to teach and, maybe even at the high school level. I never really thought of a research career.
Did you think, as you got into it, in terms of breakthroughs, discoveries that might really alter things?
No, I don't think so. I don't think so. I think a thing I went through for the first 5 years after I graduated, was that I still had many scientists on pedestals, people I really admired and worshipped and thought were superb men because I'd read their publications and so on. And I always felt a basic sense of inferiority, or at least I never felt I could ever live up to them. And all I wanted to do was to do one good experiment so that one of my heroes would pat me on the head and say, Dave, that wasn't bad. That was pretty good. And then I thought, gee, you know, I'd really have accomplished something. And that's, I think, a very harmful thing to the individual, because long, long after I graduated, I realized that ultimately you have to do something because you love to do it. If those kinds of rewards come back, then you're very fortunate. But the chance is, for most of us, those rewards won't come back. And we shouldn't be pushing ourselves to get the accolades, to get the acclaim from other people. We should feel a sense of our own dignity and worth and say, I like doing what I'm doing. People think that what I'm doing is worthwhile. That's why I'm being supported. That's good enough.
We all live in fantasy worlds, David. Did you ever fantasize that the great achievement you might get in those first few years after you graduated might be a kind of revenge or a way of getting back or a way of saying, this will show you, to the people who put you in a concentration camp in the Second World War?
No, never. Never. My involvement in science was something that, it was a passion, it totally consumed me, and it was something I couldn't do anything about. I was swept up in it. I loved it, and it never occurred to me that there would be rewards coming out of it of that type.
When you mentioned the accolades, was it perhaps recognition from the world that you felt had treated you unfairly?
Well, okay, that's a good question. I suppose that the need for this kind of recognition by people I admired was an expression of my own sense of inferiority and the fact that ever since I was a kid, I was subject to barrage by the propaganda that said that the Japanese were something less than good, ideal citizens. They were sneaky. They weren't to be trusted and so on. Sure.
The word was Jap, not Japanese.
That's correct. I can say that. You can't.
I just did.
Sure. I guess there was a drive to try to gain that sense of worth from the recognition. I think that's bad because it said I wasn't myself willing to accept that I was worthwhile. And that took a long, painful period to come through. Now, in terms of fantasy, I still daydream a hell of a lot. My most beautiful daydream is of being a star professional quarterback. I love to play football. I don't enjoy watching it that much anymore, but I love to play. And I still play a lot with my students.
David, forget it.
No. I'm just coming into my prime now. You know, a good quarterback just ages into it. It's his mind, not his body.
Okay.
The other fantasy...
There's good money in it.
The other fantasy that I spent a lot of hours daydreaming about was to change myself so that I could change my name to David Smith and have an eye operation so that my eyes are bigger and dye my hair and become like all the other kids.
A wasp.
Well, I don't know about a wasp, but not a Jap. And there were many long years spent when I was embarrassed, ashamed of my mother and father and my sisters, because they reminded me at every turn that I was Japanese.
How common is your experience?
Well, that's the intriguing question, you see. I'm afraid I haven't really had much to do with Japanese since I got into the academic profession. And I would really like to know what happened to the children who were teenagers during the Second World War, who were really at a very vulnerable stage in their lives, and being incarcerated and told, you're no longer a first-class Canadian, you're the enemy, and then coming out of that experience trying to reintegrate back into society. I really wonder what happened to them. If you look at what the history of the Japanese in Canada now, you find that they're very successful in terms of assimilation. They've become, in a sense, super white. And I suspect, although I'm not a sociologist, I don't know, I suspect that a lot of this drive to acquire all of the marks of success in Canadian society was the product of those 4 years in the camps, that they were out to disappear in white society and never be reminded of that state.
How old were you when you were taken into camp?
I was five.
Very impressionable age.
Yes, that's right. I was nine when we left. I don't know. I don't think many
Canadians...
Probably
the period of greatest learning in a child's life, isn't it?
That's what the psychologists say. That's right. I don't know if many Canadians know that Japanese couldn't even vote, even if they were Canadian-born, couldn't vote in this country until 1948. So the whole question of first-class citizenship was something that... well, it was obvious we didn't have first-class citizenship until long after the war. And that's got to have an impact of some sort. Now, I was one of the few third-generation Canadians in the camps, and I never spoke Japanese. My parents were born in this country, and English was their native language. The great majority of kids my age spoke Japanese because their parents had come from Japan. And they went to Japanese school after regular school, and they would beat me up because I couldn't speak Japanese like they did. the white kids around the villages would beat up any Japanese kid they came across because we were the enemy.
Patriotic duty.
And sure, of course. So it was a very tough time for a kid that age, not really knowing who the hell he was. Is he a Canadian? Is he a Jap? Is he a worthwhile human being? Who is going to like him? And coming out of that, hating oneself is a dreadful thing. Now, I say this now without rancor because I would like to believe that that experience has made me a better person in the end. But it was sure as hell painful to go through it.
Did it have an effect on your mental state to the point where you had to have help?
Well, I suppose you could say that. I became very involved with civil rights when I was in the United States, and that was from 54 to 58 when I was an undergraduate, and then 58 to 61 in Chicago. And in those days, the glamorous liberal thing was to participate in sit-ins and pickets and this sort of thing. Well, after I got my degree at Chicago, I spent a year with the Atomic Energy Commission in Oak Ridge, Tennessee, which is south of the Mason-Dixon line. And there I became very involved with the civil rights movement. And it was still segregated in the town. And it got so that I hated anyone who was white, simply because they were white. It got so that when I saw someone on the street who was white, I wanted to hit him. It got so that when I saw a whites-only sign, I literally threw up. I vomited. And I would say now that I was a very sick person. And that's what led me to leave the United States. I wanted to escape from the reality of what I saw in the black-white situation. I knew I wasn't coming back to a less racist country, but I knew it was less obvious and I had to get away. Well, that's that whole question of how I was going to relate to other people took a long time to work out. And in the end, I realized very painfully that if the result of being aware of inequity, of prejudice and bigotry, is that I become full of hate and spite, that I hate the oppressor, that I hate the bigot, then in a sense, you see, I've lost and they've won. Because by spewing out that, I have become them. And that's a hard thing to accept, to see the reality of prejudice and ignorance and to be able to say, I can't hate them in return because I can't let them do that to me. The natural impulse is to hate them and to feel good about hating them because you're better than they are. And yet you get right down in the mud with them. I see that, this is an aside, but I see that happening almost inevitably with any movement. I taught at Berkeley in 69 and became involved in a yellow power movement at that time with all of the rhetoric of the black movement, you know, yellow is beautiful and all that stuff. And again, there was, with group identity, a violent recoil against whites. I saw in the Chicanos, the Mexican-Americans, a violent recoil against whites, and with the Red Indians, again, that hatred. And with the gay liberation and with the women's liberation, one of the consequences of this kind of recognition of oppression is the immediate reaction is one of hatred, hatred of the oppressor. And I think it's a natural state we go through, but really, in the end, we only get to be a better people if we don't allow that hatred to consume us and get locked in that dead end of hatred and bitterness. You have to come out saying, we're still all human beings, and the bigot is just as locked into his bigotry as I am in my state of oppression.
But to say that we will not become bigots in response to bigotry and we will love our enemies is like saying, I will not die but will stay alive by continuing to live. It's beyond our capacities as human beings.
Well, I agree. I think prejudice, if we don't want to use that in a pejorative, in a nasty sense, prejudice is built into us. We have all sorts of preferences that are imposed, say, by our sex or by our race or our socioeconomic position. People may have preferences for blondes or brunettes or redheads, whether it's men or women. These kinds of prejudices we can't help. Now, when it's extended to the point of attempting to impose our prejudices, which we have to accept, on someone else's freedoms and rights, then is when I think we've got to work on it. I would be the last to say I'm not a bigot. I have all sorts of ignorance and prejudices that I can't, that right now I can't help. I think the important thing is that we've got to be aware of it and work on it. It's how we go about trying to make it a better world that counts. It's not what our end result is. We all have grand ideals of a better world where everybody is fully clothed and well-fed and so on. I don't care about those ends. The important point to me is, how do we go about trying to achieve those ends? So that in trying to accept my own basic fallibility and humanity, I try to make myself a better person by being aware of it and working on it, but never claiming that I'm above bigotry. No, I am. I agree with you. Now, one of the things that, to go way back to the question, did it have any psychological damage to me? I was raised in a culture or a cultural tradition in which the role of men and women was very clear-cut, and which at least the public role of a woman was one of passivity, of one of inferiority. The male did his number in public, at least. I had three sisters, no brothers, and I was the eldest in the family. And as the eldest in the family, I was king. I never had to make a bed or wash a dish or do the floor until I got married. And in the process of becoming a mature adult, in Canada, I became very aware that one of the most exciting things about North American society is that women have some semblance of humanity, of equality, at least aspirations to that. And the awareness of how tied in, locked in I was to my sexual role by my culture brought me into tremendous conflict with the women that I was involved with. And that took me a long time to get through, and I'm certainly a long way from being over that as well. And yes, I ended up going to a psychiatrist because I couldn't really work that out. I knew I didn't want to play the kind of roles that I was raised to play. And yet, because of all that background, I couldn't help but play those whenever I was involved with a woman. And the reality and the idealistic hope conflicted very badly, and I had to work that out. So that took me a long time, and I'm still working on that.
Well, I guess it takes all our life to grow up.
But people aren't interested in David Suzuki's personal problems.
Why not?
Everybody is complex. Everybody has their problems. We all have to work them out.
Yeah, but David Suzuki is very much in the public eye.
I'm sorry that that's the case. I wish...
That's in contradiction to what you said earlier, that it's your responsibility and your role to be in the public
eye. It's my responsibility to act as a go-between, to transmit information, and I would gladly do that anywhere, anytime, if I am available. But I don't see that that role of being the interpreter, the transmitter, should involve anybody's need to know me as a human being. You see, I'm transmitting certain information at that level. In terms of David Suzuki as a human being, someone listening to this radio program, someone watching a television program that I'm on, has no idea who I am. They hear sound waves. They see phosphorescences on their television set. But that isn't David Suzuki as a human being that can be loved or hated or respected or whatever. That only comes on a one-to-one situation. That will never come across in a lecture situation on radio or television. That's reserved for a small number of people.
The curiosity will remain, though, David. People are curious about people who tell them things.
I suppose that's something that I've had to accept very reluctantly. After we did the science program from Vancouver for 2 years, people would come up who had seen the program and had been interested and simply wanted to make some kind of human contact and say, oh, I watched your program. I really enjoyed it. And I never knew how to react to that. And my wife always says, you know, that I'm very cool, and I project resentment that they are interfering, infringing on my own personal life. And yet she claims that by acting as a public communicator, I have assumed that responsibility to let people come in and know me. And I still find that a very hard thing to really work out in my mind.
What happens with most people in the position you describe is that they work very hard to maintain a private, inside person that no one else can ever get at. Have you done that?
Oh, yes. I think there are parts of me that only the most loved people in my life will ever know about. On the other hand, we've just talked about some things that are very, very personal. In a sense, I worry that it's embarrassing to other people. Because they're very important to me. I don't know how important they would be to other people. What makes me sad is that I wish people didn't have the need to get into the personal lives of public figures, because I find that people are so fascinating and so complex that any person has people around him who, if they really got to know them, would have a lot to offer them. And they have the great advantage of being living human beings.
Do you think you can separate the scientist from the human being?
For me, I can't separate my science from what I am. My science was a very important, and is a very important part of my life. In fact, there was a period in my life when I was virtually living at my lab. I would stay there for 2 and 3 nights running and just work until I couldn't see anymore, then sleep for a few hours and work some more. And finally, my wife at that time said, look, you know, we're not living a normal life, and you've got to make your mind up whether it's going to be partly science and partly your family or all science. Now, at that time in my youth, I felt that to give up science in any way would have been to rip off my right arm and my left leg. And so we made that choice that my marriage broke up. That was a very difficult decision, and it was, to me, an indication of just how important science was. I'm not saying that was a right decision, but it certainly... I couldn't separate science at that time from what I was as a human being. A very major part of what made David Suzuki whatever he was at that time was science.
Warren Davis with David Suzuki in September 1975. I'm Judy Madryn, and you're listening to Rewind here on Sirius Radio 137. That same year, 1975, just weeks after the interview we just heard, was the inaugural episode of the CBC science program Quirks and Quarks. Here's a taste.
Welcome to my show, a weekly peek into the world of science and scientists. You only have to look around your home to see that science affects you in all sorts of ways in your daily life. Try reading the chemicals on food package labels, or look into your medicine cabinet, or peer into the back of your radio. On Quirks and Quarks, we'll see what excites and worries scientists. We'll have a regular visit with world-renowned author and popularizer of science, Isaac Asimov, who will explain the origins of common scientific words. Writer Richard Lubbock will try to answer questions you've always wondered about. We'll meet ordinary Canadians who've devised new inventions. And periodically, we'll have book reviews, scientific scandals, and looks at past predictions of scientific progress. You know, the Emperor of Japan, Hirohito, is touring the United States now. I find it interesting to see that, although he doesn't have a PhD, he's one of the world's few experts on jellyfish. Apparently, he has a complete lab set up in the Imperial Palace and is happiest when he's there doing science. Even on this 2-week tour of the United States, he's scheduled to spend a lot of time visiting scientific labs. So you don't have to have a PhD to be interested in science, or the Emperor of Japan, for that matter.
From October 8, 1975, some of the very first edition of Quirks and Quarks. Now, an interview from October 1980 from Morningside with Don Herron. By this time, Suzuki was hosting The Nature of Things on CBC television.
And now a special welcome to someone we hope will be a fairly regular occasional guest on Morningside. I know he's a busy fellow. David Suzuki, the host of CBC TV's The Nature of Things. Good morning, David.
Good morning, Don.
Last week, you were speaking in Vancouver about the teaching of science in schools in Canada. And I gather from the press reports of the speech, you don't think much of how it's done.
That's true. I knocked the science or the educators pretty hard. I said that they're really failing to train or teach students to confront the greatest force that is going to affect these children's lives when they become adults. You know, if we came down onto this planet from Mars and looked at the newspapers and watched the national news every night at 11 and tried to judge what were the most important issues facing Canadians today.
The Constitution.
The Constitution. We'd say the price of a barrel of oil next year, the cost of an ounce of gold, whether or not Quebec's going to separate, unemployment, inflation.
Now, doesn't the price of a barrel of oil imply science?
Maybe, perhaps. There's a lot of politics involved. But what I like to say is, look, consider what the world was like when you and I were kids. When you and I were kids, it was dangerous to go to movies in the summer because we'd catch polio.
When you were a kid, I was already grown up. Polio. I remember the epidemic about 1936 when I had to stay home from school for almost a month and a half.
There was one in the 50s in the Maritimes that crippled hundreds of people. And yet children today have no idea, you know. Hundreds of thousands of people used to die or were scarred permanently.
You mean they don't know who Jonas Salk is? Or...
Exactly. I mean, they take it for granted. You take your pill and that's it. But I'm trying to say that the world has changed enormously, right? They didn't worry about how much television you or I watched because there was no CBC television. There was no television. There were no satellites, computers, Xerox machines, oral contraceptives, nuclear power. All of these things have happened during our lifetime. And the world has been changed far more profoundly by those things than any of the politicians or political issues that have come up.
And has the world been changed more profoundly in the last, say, 50 years than it has in the following previous 1,500?
Oh, obviously. Obviously.
But people are not aware of this,
are they? Everything's being scaled down, you know. Huh?
People are not aware of this.
It's funny, you know, I've gone out in the street. We do these streeters where you stand in front of a radio store with where people come out with the latest laser discs or transistorized gizmos, and you go up to them and say, do you think science affects you in your daily life? The overwhelming majority of people will say, no, not really. And half of them will say, I was never any good at math anyway. And I accuse the teachers of fostering this attitude. You know, Mary, because girls usually are geared or funneled away from science, Mary is told, look, you're not that good in math, so why don't you go into English or history or something like that? And from that point on, it's as if for that child, science is no longer relevant to that child's life. And the end result is, the girl graduates from high school, goes to university. The chances are overwhelming. They'll take a birth control pill and have no idea what that pill is doing to their body. They'll have to go out, men and women, and decide, what should we do with a CANDU nuclear reactor? Or what are PCBs and are they dangerous? They're going to have to handle these issues, and they simply don't know what to do with it.
Now, are you blaming the vocational guidance department of our schools or the science teachers themselves?
I'm blaming the whole educational system, which is geared towards getting a small number of kids out to the university to go on in science. That's 5% at the most of all the students that start in grade school. And the whole system is geared towards, well, teaching Johnny math so that next year they can take chemistry and next year biology and so on, until you get to a very small number of kids in high school that are taking these highly specialized courses in science.
So the trouble starts in the elementary grades?
I think so. They're funneled at a very early age. And you can tell their inclinations and then kind of gear them along different streams.
Now, my child is away on a three-day camp. I assume it's nature, but surely that is a beginning.
Well, you see, I think you're right. When I used to take my children for walks in the woods, they knew without me saying, all right, kids, this is ecology. This is serious stuff. They knew where to go and find salamanders. They knew where you found the wood-boring beetles. They knew all of these things through experience and through lifting rocks and logs and so on. They knew all of that, and they were excited about it and would run around and look and show me. By the time they get to high school, something's gone. You know, they know, Ah, that's a stupid question. I shouldn't ask that.
Is it the option of saying I can study this instead of that? Is that the problem?
I think part of it is that when we say this is science, this is serious, and science is done by people in white lab coats, and you know you've got to set up the experiment and say this is what we're trying to find, this is the apparatus, this is how we did it, these are the results. And somehow they feel that's science. And asking, Mommy, why are grown-ups so big when I'm so small? Or what is a shooting star? Or, you know, why do the hind end of worms still wriggle when I break it in half? Somehow that's thought to be either a silly question or something that's not what scientists ask. And yet those are the really exciting and profound questions.
Are we coming to the dilemma that C.P. Snow talked about, that there are two worlds?
We're not coming to it. That situation
it's continuing.
Is exactly. And I'm saying that it's becoming much more formalized in the schools, and that the cultures are getting further and further apart. Now, let me tell you what the end result is. We now elect politicians to Ottawa who are going to make decisions about whether to sell 16 nuclear reactors to Romania or Argentina or South Korea. Now, these guys, over 80% of them in Ottawa, come from two areas of society. And this was shown in a survey done a couple of years ago. They come from business or they come from law. Now, there's nothing wrong with that. I mean, some lawyers and businessmen are good friends of mine. when you do a test or a quiz of politicians in Ottawa for how well they understand simple scientific terms or concepts, it's businessmen and lawyers who score so low. If they were in my class, I'd put them in a grade for the retarded. They simply cannot handle science concepts. And they're going to decide on the CANDU reactor.
Now, do they have experts who help them?
Of course. They have advisors, and that's the big out they have. Well, you know, I'm not going to be an expert on nuclear physics, but I have all these scientists who come up, but ultimately, who give me advice. But ultimately, the politician's got to carry the can. He's got to take the responsibility for the decision. He gets all of this high-powered advice, but he's got to read that stuff and then say, gee, you know, gosh, these radioisotopes hang around for 150,000 years. Gee, Argentina's pretty volatile. What if they want to make a bomb that fits in a suitcase?
Can you think of a politician in the world today who is a trained scientist?
Well, Margaret Thatcher, apparently.
Chemistry,
ironic.
Wasn't it?
Yes, that's right. And they claim that Jimmy Carter was a nuclear engineer.
He was on a sub.
So there are a few, not many. I'm not saying that politicians should be scientists. But I'm saying politicians have to make decisions day after day that involve some application of science. And if they're scientifically illiterate, then how the hell are they ever going to take that input seriously?
But at the university level, today it's the art students that are floundering. They say, I don't know whether to take a course or not because I can't get a job. Whereas the science people are going to get employment.
Right.
Practically guaranteed.
The problem with the two cultures is, on the one hand, art students graduate and they say, we're liberally educated. We're really educated. We know a whole range of subjects. Except the one area that is going to affect them more powerfully than any other, science.
What do you think of a publication like Omni, which is Bob Guccione, Mr. Penthouse's attempt to interest people and get them passionate about science?
I tend to be a bit snotty about that. I think it's science porn. And if you look at it, you know, the pictures are every bit as slick as you'd find in Playboy or Penthouse. And it tends to the fringe areas of UFOs and the areas where really people are intrigued by these kinds of ESPs and so on.
Does it pique their curiosity and lead them to go on to other investigations?
Well, I'll tell you, what I suggest, again, is that education fails us because the people who come out of the schools will read an article in Penthouse and then go around and tell all their friends, hey, did you know that we're going to live to 140 years within 10 years? And you say, well, how do you know that? That's really exciting. They say, well, I read in Omni.
It's like the Reader's Digest School of Medicine.
I'm not saying that the stuff in Omni couldn't be good, but your readers don't even critically assess it. And they will cite an article from the National Enquirer, from Omni or Penthouse or from The New Scientist with equal ease. It's as if it's printed on paper, darn it, it's true.
What about Dr. Isaac Asimov, people like that?
Asimov is a man of incredible talent. There's just no doubt. I'm a big fan of Asimov.
So is science fiction the way in?
But he wouldn't call himself a science fiction writer, but I'm an avid fan of science fiction. And certainly that's enough to pique your interest. But I think there's always a concern that science fiction appeals very much to the fictional side. But I'd say anybody that takes science seriously, you know, has got a leg up in terms of handling the forces that affect his life.
What about the job of the Science Center in Toronto, where they make the kids' hair stand on end?
Fantastic. Absolutely fantastic.
Is this happening anywhere else in Canada?
Costs a hell of a lot of money. And even the Science Center now, I think, is always having problems with money. In BC, they're trying to set one up, but, you know, you're talking millions of dollars, and if you have a group of politicians who don't take science seriously, how are they going to spring loose the millions of dollars it takes to build a science center?
Well, they keep saying that research gets the short end of the stick in this country.
Well, that's what scientists keep saying, and it's true.
But I read it in the press a lot. Mm-hmm. But one of the problems we cannot compete with our exports is that we have no research.
Well, you're getting into a whole different area. I think that the problem in Canada is more of a psychological one. And I've written to Mr. Trudeau about this a number of times over the years.
And what has he replied?
Well, my contention is, if you don't have a people that believe they can be first rate, then no amount of money that you pour in is going to develop excellence here. And you know, the thing that's disheartening about this country is that my son a few years ago, and this is strictly anecdotal, really believed that Canadians at least were first rate in hockey. And I've seen him, as he got older, become more and more cynical about Canadian hockey. Well, what does a Canadian child have to really look up to and say, we as Canadians are world rate in what? Unless we revel in our outstanding people and say, of course we can be first rate. Of course our scientists will compete everywhere with other scientists around the world. Of course we're not going to let our best scientists go to the United States or Britain. We're going to give them the facilities and support here. Then I think if the federal government pours millions of dollars in and we don't have that mentality, it's of no use. We've got to believe in ourselves.
So is it a matter of PR to tell the story of Northern Telecom,
well,
things like that?
Those things help. Again, if you go into the schools and ask children, name five famous Canadian scientists. I defy you to find many people anywhere.
Ask me.
Okay.
I would.
The answers will shock you. They will claim Madame Curie, Albert Einstein. These are the kinds of people that they just throw out because they're names that they've heard in school. Now, scientists often say, well, you know, science is international. It's being chauvinistic if you talk about a Canadian identity or Canadian science. That's baloney. I mean, ultimately, Canadian taxpayers support Canadian science. Canadian science is a part of our culture, just like ballet or art.
But what you're getting to is the fundamental root of Canadianism. We don't think that we're that good.
It's, exactly.
We are a modest nation because, as somebody said, we have much to be modest about. And so we're pouring $10 billion in investment across the border. We're controlling Dallas, but we don't control Vancouver and Toronto.
Well, the other thing, too, of course, is that we have incredible people in Canada of enormous talent in science and the arts. But who do we take pride in? Lorne Greene. I don't claim Lorne Greene as a Canadian. He's an American, for God's sake. He happened to be born in Canada. He's down in the States. I'm not interested in Lorne Greene. I'm interested in Canadians that have stayed in this country because they believe in it. And I think that it should apply in science as well as every other area. But we're constantly looking for some kind of stamp of success by whether they made it in another country.
From October 1980, David Suzuki with Don Herron on Morningside. And now, just a little bit of an interview that David Suzuki did with Vicki Gabbro on the program Variety Tonight in 1981. In it, he talks about the influence his father had on him in some surprising ways.
Are you much of a dancer?
Well, I love to dance. I'd never claim to be a good dancer. But it's interesting, my father always felt, being a Japanese in Canada, he said, you know, if you're going to accomplish anything in your life, first of all, you have to be twice as good as the next person because you're the wrong race. But he said, I think there are two things that will be very important for you when you get older. One is that you must be able to get up off on your feet and speak extemporaneously. That's a very important attribute. And he used to enter me into oratorical contests and make me memorize my speeches and do all this stuff. And the other thing was you had to be able to dance. I think they were reflections of what he thought he was deficient in.
Does he dance? Have you taught him to dance?
Oh, perhaps? I haven't seen him dance since I was a young kid.
So you're smooth on the floor, are you?
Oh, I jump up and down. I mean, once the 60s hit, it was great. You know, all you have to do is keep
you
beat.
Old hippie, you. And what about the speaking extemporaneously? You do that pretty well, too.
That I really give full credit to my father for. What he used to do was really incredible. I'd have to write out my speeches. And then every evening after dinner, he would take me down in the basement and say, all right, I want you to give that speech. And he would go through it. If I made a single mistake, I'd have to stop and start at the beginning. And he would say, now, you've got to move, make a gesture. You've got to move. You've got to smile. I mean, all of this was programming. Some extemporaneous speech, eh?
Right.
And every night, invariably, I'd end up in tears, just out of frustration and rage at doing it over and over. But it really did pay off.
Well, it obviously has. You're kind of, he's kind of the Walt Gretzky of the, if you get my drift. Obviously, he was a tremendous influence, or is
influence. Yes, anyway. He certainly is. He's quite a man.
From 1981, Vicky Gaboreau and David Suzuki. In 1985, Quirks and Quarks celebrated its 10th anniversary. And although the show was hosted by Jay Ingram at this point, they invited David back to help celebrate.
David, we've heard today about the tremendous advances in computer technology, silicon chip technology, and the exploration of space. But I guess that you as a geneticist must be really impressed with the advances made in genetics in the last 10 years.
Well, I would think that biotechnology will be regarded as one of the great areas in the last part of the 20th century, along with microelectronics, no question about it. At the beginning of Quirks and Quarks in 75, we were really reeling under the impact of the proposed moratorium on recombinant DNA work, because at that time there was real concern that maybe this technology would lead to the generation of microorganisms that might be dangerous.
And might escape from the lab in that
that's
sort
right.
of scenario.
And I think that was a very interesting time. But during that whole kind of controversy, there was at the same time a great deal of work going on that showed that there was enormous potential for application of this technology. And essentially, that moratorium lasted a couple of years, and then it was kind of full speed ahead. And the advances that have happened since then have been truly staggering. When I go into the lab at UBC, and my lab still continues under someone else's direction, I find undergraduates are doing experiments that I never dreamed I would see in my lifetime. It is nothing now to be able to reach into a cell, pull out a piece of DNA, and actually read the sequence of letters along its length in a day. This is something that an undergraduate can do. It's nothing to reach into a cell and pull out a minute quantity of protein, determine the amino acid sequence in the protein, and then using that to make a gene that corresponds to that protein and synthesize it, all of it automatically. They're now sequencing of the order of 10 to 20,000 letters a day, a week in the human genetic makeup. By the end of this century, we may very well have a complete description of all of the DNA in human beings. Now, that's something I just never thought would be possible.
Do you think there's one area that's going to be, that the impact is going to be greatest on, like, say, medical? Is that going to be the biggest?
Medicine certainly is the area where the payoff is apparent. We've already got insulin now that's available to human beings that is identical to human insulin, but it's made by bacteria. And that has been a staggering achievement through the techniques that we have. Human growth hormone has been made in bacteria and is now being used to treat children with stunted growth. The promises for agriculture, forestry, mining remain every bit as great, but I think they're a longer way off. Another phenomenon that happened during our 10 years has been the growth of genetic engineering companies. Mm-hmm. And there have been literally hundreds of them growing up. And the interesting thing now is that there is a shakedown period. They ain't paying off. Multi millions of bucks have been spent investing in biotechnology companies, and very few of them are surviving now. Even Walter Gilbert, who won a Nobel Prize at Harvard for his work and became the head of Biogen, has now been booted out of Biogen because it hasn't worked out. He's gone back to Harvard. And I would say that the vast majority of these companies are going to go belly up. And you're going to get a shakedown, and a few of the really strong companies are going to continue on and make money, like Genentech at Stanford. And they're going to make money in medicine, maybe agriculture in the future.
But even so, even if it's not going to be quite as great a boom as some had envisioned, you still think it'll be perhaps the scientific advance that will be looked back on as the most important in this last 10 years?
Well, there's no question it has the greatest significance. And I think, I hope that when we look back and come together in 20 years for your 20th anniversary, that we won't be realizing that the gene therapy in humans, which I don't think is any question it's around the corner, that we'll be introducing pieces of DNA into sick children to try to cure them. I hope in 20 years we won't be saying we shouldn't have done that.
Thanks, David.
From the program that celebrated the 10th anniversary of Quirks and Quarks. David Suzuki has five children, three that he had with his first wife, Joanne, and two more with his second wife, Dr. Tara Cullis. And in 1992, his 12-year-old daughter, Severn Cullis Suzuki, made a splash at the Rio Earth Summit on the Environment and Development. She delivered an impassioned speech about the environment, which many delegates felt was the highlight of the conference.
Hello, I'm Severn Suzuki, speaking for ECHO, the Environmental Children's Organization. We're a group of 12 and 13-year-olds trying to make a difference. Vanessa Setti, Morgan Geisler, Michelle Quigg, and me. We've raised all the money to come here ourselves, to come 5,000 miles to tell you adults you must change your ways. Coming up here today, I have no hidden agenda. I am fighting for my future. Losing my future is not like losing an election or a few points on the stock market. I am here to speak for all generations to come. I am here to speak on behalf of the starving children around the world whose cries go unheard. I am here to speak for the countless animals dying across this planet because they have nowhere left to go. I am afraid to go out in the sun now because of the holes in our ozone. I am afraid to breathe the air because I don't know what chemicals are in it. I used to go fishing in Vancouver, my home, with my dad, until just a few years ago we found the fish full of cancers. And now we hear of animals and plants going extinct every day, vanishing forever. In my life, I have dreamt of seeing the great herds of wild animals, jungles and rainforests full of birds and butterflies. But now I wonder if they will even exist for my children to see. Did you have to worry of these things when you were my age? All this is happening before our eyes, and yet we act as if we have all the time we want and all the solutions. I'm only a child, and I don't have all the solutions. But I want you to realize, neither do you. You don't know how to fix the holes in our ozone layer. You don't know how to bring the salmon back up in a dead stream. You don't know how to bring back an animal now extinct. And you can't bring back the forest that once grew where there is now a desert. If you don't know how to fix it, please stop breaking it. Here, you may be delegates of your government, business people, organizers, reporters, or politicians. But really, your mothers and fathers, sisters and brothers, aunts and uncles, and all of you are someone's child. I'm only a child, yet I know we are all part of a family, 5 billion strong. In fact, 30 million species strong. And borders and governments will never change that. I'm only a child, yet I know we are all in this together and should act as one single world towards one single goal. In my anger, I am not blind, and in my fear, I am not afraid of telling the world how I feel. In my country, we make so much waste. We buy and throw away, and yet northern countries will not share with the needy. Even when we have more than enough, we are afraid to share. We are afraid to let go of some of our wealth. In Canada, we live the privileged life, with plenty of food, water, and shelter. We have watches, bicycles, computers, and television sets. The list could go on for 2 days. 2 days ago, here in Brazil, we were shocked when we spent time with some children living on the streets. This is what one child told us. I wish I was rich. And if I were, I would give all the street children food, clothes, medicines, shelter, and love and affection. If a child on the streets who has nothing is willing to share, why are we who have everything still so greedy? I can't stop thinking that these are children my own age, that it makes a tremendous difference where you are born. That I could be one of those children living in the favelas of Rio. I could be a child starving in Somalia, or a victim of war in the Middle East, or a beggar in India. I am only a child, yet I know if all the money spent on war was spent on finding environmental answers, ending poverty, and finding treaties, what a wonderful place this earth would be. At school, even in kindergarten, you teach us how to behave in the world. You teach us to not to fight with others, to work things out, to respect others, to clean up our mess, not to hurt other creatures, to share, not be greedy. Then why do you go out and do the things you tell us not to do? Do not forget why you are attending these conferences, who you're doing this for. We are your own children. You are deciding what kind of a world we are growing up in. Parents should be able to comfort their children by saying, everything's going to be all right. It's not the end of the world. And we're doing the best we can. But I don't think you can say that to us anymore. Are we even on your list of priorities? My dad always says, you are what you do, not what you say. Well, what you do makes me cry at night. You grown-ups say you love us, but I challenge you, please, make your actions reflect your words. Thank you.
David Suzuki's daughter, Severin Cullis Suzuki, age 12, at the Rio Earth Summit on the Environment and Development in 1992. Severin graduated from Yale University in May 2002 with a degree in evolutionary biology and ecology. While at Yale, she helped write The Recognition of Responsibility for Young People. The document encourages young people to commit to a more sustainable lifestyle. She has since completed her master's in ethnobotany from the University of Victoria. In 1990, David Suzuki established the David Suzuki Foundation. Its mission is to work through science and education to protect the diversity of nature. He is also the host of The Nature of Things on CBC Television. And that's our show for today. I hope you enjoyed it. Our thanks to the people at the CBC Archives site for helping out on this program. They are at cbc.ca/archives. Rewind is produced by Marika Mayer. I'm Judy Madron. Goodbye.
And that's all for the Rewind podcast this week. If you'd like to hear more great material from the CBC Radio Archives, tune in to Rewind. It airs Thursday nights at midnight on CBC Radio 1, and the rest of the week Sunday through Friday at 2 p.m. and again at 1 a.m. and 5 a.m. on Sirius Radio 137. I'll be back next week with a new episode of Rewind. I'm Michael Enright. Thank you for listening.
Hi, I'm Jesse Brown. I'm the host of Search Engine, a new CBC radio show that is all about how the internet is changing politics and culture. It's not a gadget show. We don't really care much about technology so much as we care about the effect that technology is having on the world that we live in. All of the surprising and significant and funny stories that we bring you on Search Engine are about things that are happening right now. In the short time that we've been on the air, we've already become the CBC's most popular news podcast in the States. So come find out why. Subscribe to our podcast on CBC's podcasting page or through iTunes.